Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the show today, we'll be talking a little bit about the current scandal in Washington involving lobbyist, former lobbyist, perhaps one should say, Jack Abramoff. He's now pleaded guilty to three felony counts of conspiracy of mail fraud and tax evasion, and apparently has agreed to cooperate in the further investigation of corruption in the government. One result has been that now many members of Congress, both Republicans and Democrats, have called for tightening the rules governing lobbying. At the same time, Paul Miller, he speaks for the industry, he's president of the American League of Lobbyists, says that we don't really need new rules on lobbying, we just need to have better enforcement of the laws that we already have. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking a little bit about lobbying, policymaking, and influence, what the process is, how it works. And our guest for the program is Marie Honyaki. She is associate professor of political science at Penn State and has written quite a lot on this particular subject. She's joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, of course, questions and comments are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us. If it would be a long-distance call for you, you're listening around Illinois and Indiana. In fact, anybody who might be listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, you can also use that number. That's 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Professor Honyaki, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
I'm good.
Thanks for talking with us.
Sure,
we appreciate
for inviting
it.
Me.
You know, as I now have read a number of stories specifically about Mr. Abramoff and his situation, and maybe I should say right in the beginning that we don't really want to focus so much specifically on him as on the larger picture. But having read a number of stories, they are liberally salted with references to past abuses and attempts, particularly in the 19th and the early 20th century, to tighten the laws to make sure that it's difficult, or at least we're doing what we can to stop the buying of votes and the buying of influence. Mm-hmm. Having said that, I think you can also see complaints about this going all the way back to the beginning, at least back to the first Congress. There were people who were trying to influence members of Congress by whatever means they could, by giving them money, by giving them gifts, influence them to pass legislation that benefited them and their friends and the businesses that they represented. So there's really nothing new about this. Now, having said that, looking at the point that we are now with this as much money that goes into the lobbying effort, with as many people that are involved, is there something really different about the place that we are now? If you look back to the past points where people were concerned about the influence of lobbyists,
well, it's in some ways it probably has changed. I mean, I'm not a historian, and I don't know. I don't have sort of detailed information about, you know, lobbying at in the first Congress or anything like that. But, you know, the basic idea of people, organized individuals, unorganized groups, single individuals trying to affect policy is something that is really part of our government, the right to petition the government. And so when the founders were thinking about how they were going to construct the government, they were aware of the fact that people were going to try to have an effect on what legislators and policymakers were going to do, but at the same time, restrictions on petitioning the government have always been kind of people sort of involved with thinking about how to design the process so that it works have always been a little bit careful about not putting too many restrictions on petitioning the government, because it is something that we allow in our system. What I think probably has changed, certainly since the 1970s and 1980s, has been the volume both of organized groups of different types of organizations, and I can talk more about that if you're interested, and also the professionalization of these organizations that are involved in making, you know, bringing, advancing their interests and advocating their concerns before government.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's maybe we can talk about that a little bit, because certainly it is striking, one of the things, again, that you see when you read about what has happened to the industry over the last few decades. One thing that strikes you is that the number of registered lobbyists has grown significantly, say,
absolutely,
since the 1980s, for example. Yes. And the other is the amount of money that's spent in the lobbying effort. Mm-hmm. Now, for example, people are concerned about the amount of money that's spent on political campaigns in the United mm-hmm. States. Well, lobbyists spent, at least according to what I read, they spend twice as much mm-hmm. As is spent on political campaigns. So there's a lot of money put into this effort, mm-hmm. and there are an awful lot of people doing it. Is it the case that today there are organizations that have people in Washington representing them that in the past just didn't do that?
Yes, there are. And that's something that has tended to happen in sort of, I guess for lack of a better term, different waves. In the 1970s and early 1980s, you saw both an increase in the number of general, I don't like to use the word citizen groups, but groups that were comprised of people who had some interest in, who didn't come together because of some sort of professional association or common profession or occupation, but rather some common interest. Mm-hmm. So you saw a rise in those types of organizations in the 70s and 80s. The business community, some would say, organized or had a bigger presence in Washington in response to that. More recently, you saw, as technology has changed, a lot of organizations that initially had not been particularly active in petitioning the government, like Microsoft, were realizing that you can't be a big corporation without taking an interest in the kinds of things that Washington is doing. So more recently, we saw a big increase in technology firms and you know, also in the 1980s and 1990s, a big increase in the presence in Washington of organizations that were representing institutions, you know, hospitals, universities, those sorts of things.
One of the things that I wanted to do was to talk a little bit about the rules under which lobbyists operate now, mm-hmm. and perhaps we can also talk a little bit about what has been proposed, and it doesn't really sound like it's fundamentally very different from what already exists, but that now members of Congress, as I said at the beginning, both Republicans and Democrats are talking about needing to tighten up the rules. Mm-hmm. But to talk about the rules as they are now, maybe let me ask you about a few basic things. For example, the fact is that now that lobbyists must register, what exactly does that mean?
Well, they have to. There is an office in the Senate, and it's called the Office of the Clerk of the Senate. And twice a year, organizations that are planning to have, typically planning, it doesn't, you know, need to be that you're, you know, immediately involved, but planning to have some involvement or interaction with a member of Congress or a member's staff, you need to register, as you say. And that basically means that you fill out it's a relatively short form, and you indicate, and let me talk first just about, let's say that I'm a lobbyist for the National Association of Realtors. Mm-hmm. So I organize, or I go to the office, I submit this form, I indicate that my employer is the National Association of Realtors, I give my name, I talk about how much money my organization spends on lobbying generally in a given year. If it's less than 10% of our overall budget, I think that's the figure, I don't have to register at all. But as long as it's a relatively large proportion of the organizational budget, I do that. I register. And I have to indicate by way of a number of the form has a bunch of different policy areas like Health and Human Services budget. So these are broad categories. I have to indicate in which areas I'm going to lobby or make contact. And if there's more than one of those areas, or if there is more than one lobbyist for the National Association of Realtors, we each have to file. We each have to indicate what areas we're going to lobby in. And an optional part of the form is for me then to provide more detail. So I could say, I'm going to lobby on the budget, in the area of the budget, and I'm going to lobby on regulations that have to do with, something that realtors would be interested in. But that's kind of optional. And so it's some pretty basic information about who is making contact with members of Congress and their staff. But it is restricted to that kind of effort at influence, I guess. So that particular activity. If I'm trying to get local realtors to contact their members of Congress, and that's all I'm going to do, I don't have to file that form.
The other thing that is being discussed has to do with disclosure, and that apparently there is some disclosure that's required periodically, and what some members of Congress want is for there to be, instead of doing that annually, maybe the idea now is that you're going to do that twice a year. And what is not exactly clear to me is what exactly that means. Do you, as a lobbyist, do you have to report who it is that you talk to, or anything that you do for them, anything that you give them? What exactly is required in terms of your talking about what you have done?
Well, the form that I just described to you, that sort of registration, that basic registration, is all that really one needs to do to formally comply with the Lobby Disclosure Act of 1995. Mm-hmm. So I don't have to tell you who I'm going to talk to. I don't have to tell you if I'm going to talk to certain individuals in I don't believe that it covers individuals in the executive branch. Separate from that, I think Congress has some sort of requirement that you disclose, but I thought this was actually what members of Congress had to do. You have to indicate whether or not you've received gifts, even if they're below some certain dollar amount, from people outside of government. But that's pretty much it. So there's not a lot of detail, and so I'm not really sure. I've heard, as you have, about efforts to increase the frequency with which lobbyists have to file these forms. And while it's a tremendous change from, I mean, prior to 1995, there was next to no disclosure. So you didn't even really know who was having contact with members of Congress in different policy areas. So I think, at least from the social science standpoint, it's been nice to have that information, but increasing the frequency of it, I don't really think buys you much of anything or gets you anything more useful than what you have now.
Mm.
Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I would just think then it's in a sense, it's incumbent on the members to talk, to disclose whatever contacts they have had. It's more on them rather than we're saying to the lobbyists that they have to report who it is that they've been talking to.
Yeah, and members of Congress don't like to tell you who they talk to, and lobbyists don't like to tell you who they talk to. In the project that I did, we tried to find out that information, and in many cases, you know, we were sort of greeted as if we were, you know, asking for state secrets. But I think that one of the most important things that we as a society could know about is how do members spend their time. I mean, that's a really precious commodity for a member of Congress. And so knowing with whom members of Congress spend their time and who they listen to would be, you know, a great bit of information to have disclosed. But that's not what anybody is really talking about. What they're talking about are, you know, lobbyists filing more forms or with more regularity, at least as I've understood what has been proposed.
So can you say even something general about, say, take your average member of Congress, how many contacts that member has with lobbyists, how many different lobbyists? Do the lobbyists mostly have dealings with the member's staff, or are there what kind of personal contacts there are and what kind of contacts they are? Is it possible to say anything like that?
No, not really. We know very little about those sorts of things. I mean, what political scientists have tried to understand, but we just really don't have any kind of data or observation on this. We sort of recognize that there are probably qualitative differences in the kind of access that different groups have, for example. So, and what I mean by that, for example, is, you know, maybe if I'm I'm picking on the National Association of Realtors, but if I'm the National Association of Realtors, maybe I get to meet with Dennis Hastert. And if I am, some type of citizens group that happens to represent people who come from families who experience some type of mental illness, maybe I meet with members of his staff. And so qualitatively, there's probably a difference in not only how the information that I convey is heard, but also the priority that is given by that member. Certainly, if the member is spending, especially someone in the leadership, is spending time with a representative of an organization, I would have to imagine that means something different than spending time with a staffer. But we just don't know about that because there is no disclosure of that kind of information.
Mm-hmm. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Marie Honyaki. She's Associate Professor of Political Science at Penn State University and has no connection whatsoever with the National Association of Realtors. We're talking here this morning about lobbying, policymaking, and influence in Washington, something that she's interested in and has done a lot of writing about. Questions, comments are welcome, 333-9455. That's for Champaign Urbana folks, and we do also have the toll-free line, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with someone in Indiana there, line number 4. Hello.
Hello. This is one of those problems that you require all day, I would guess, especially since there's no quantitative way, I guess, to wrap it up. And it's also like the fox watching the chickens. In terms of the history of this, has there always been, in a sense, almost yearly we have these flare-ups between lobbyists or so-called lobbyists and somebody in Congress. I was wondering if this has been going on quite some time or whether there are other ways to make a silk purse out of a pig's ear, so to speak. Most of the people from my state, I know where they stand on everything, and I'm not in favor of them, but unfortunately that's what's going on. So what is it, just the little side issues they want to get into a bill that's important for the lobbyist, a special phrase or something like that? In a sense, what's the mechanics going on, whether it's right or wrong, as far as that goes? We're often left with the impression on radio and TV that, as you say, the Association for Secondary Mental Health People are going to talk to a staff member, perhaps, but the people who got the bread, they talk to the man himself for a period of time, may even go on a jaunt with him or something. I just wonder how these fellows clear it all in their heads. Actually, after some of the statements they make, you know, on the stump, then when they actually get into Washington, D.C., where does that issue lie, if that is an issue at all? Is that just politics and we have to accept it? Thanks.
Well, can you comment on some of that?
Yeah. A number of interesting points that the caller raises and asks about. Let me sort of talk about mechanics first. You know, the caller asked about, you know, how does it, is it about the insertion of a phrase or a word? And you know, this is one of the most, I think, difficult things about, you know, the Jack Abramoff scandal does a nice job of illustrating how bribery and coercion work. I don't think it does a very good job of illustrating how lobbying happens in Washington, and lobbying, that term, or advocacy, as I think I sometimes would prefer to call it, is a multifaceted activity, and in some cases it involves what the kinds of things that Abramoff was involved with, which was, you know, here is this one little phrase that I need you to put into this huge budget bill, and this phrase is going to make sure that, you know, I don't know, the way that, you know, some sort of gambling regulations are issued in the states are going to be affected by this language. And you've heard people talk about that mechanism, which is basically this effort to earmark things, which have increased, you know, the use of earmarks has increased tremendously over the last 5 to 10 years. I saw some figures yesterday which suggested that, you know, that they've gone from roughly, you know, 1,400 earmarks about 5 years ago to 14,000 now. I mean, the use of earmarks has just skyrocketed. And, you know, that's not the only, you know, so that to me is kind of a troubling issue when policy is made by the insertion of a word or a phrase in a larger bill where no one really is paying attention to it. But that's not all, you know, that's not the only way that policy is made. Policy can be made through regulations issued by agencies. They can be part of, you know, some things can't happen by way of insertion of a small item on a budget bill, but you actually have to try to pass a whole separate piece of legislation to make something happen. And when you talk to lobbyists, there are a lot of people in Washington that are incredibly frustrated by the amount of gridlock and the difficulty of getting things done. And, you know, I'm sure they even look at these earmarks and think, gosh, that seems like an easy way to make things happen. So the mechanism for exerting influence or attempting to exert influence is, you know, there are many different mechanisms through which that happens. And then how it affects the members themselves and the decisions that they make, again, is also tricky because, you know, a lot of the advocacy that we see happen, a lot of the contacts between lobbyists and legislators and between PACs and the members that they contribute to are occurring between sort of like-minded entities, you know, members and organizations that are already predisposed to sort of share certain views on public policy. And so it's difficult to separate out the effect of the money being given or the contact and information that's being conveyed or the gift that's being given and how that's really shaping the way these members are actually acting. Again, I think some of it, I don't want to just harp on this point, but, you know, how members of Congress spend their time is really important. And if information from an organization or money from an organization affects a member in terms of how they allocate their time, then that to me is a group successfully having influence. The part about precisely whether a member votes or acts in a particular way because of something they heard from a group, that's a pretty tricky thing to parse out.
Well, you know, I think this, you make a really interesting point here because so much of, it seems that what has been written and what members of Congress have said as under the heading of addressing this problem of lobbying has to do with lobbyists and their contacts with members and the business of disclosure and limiting the gifts that can be given and the kind of trips that you can take people on and so forth. But I think that some people have actually said really the thing that we need to look that that's fine, but that they also need to look at the way Congress does business, the whole process of what happens on the floor there in the Congress, and that what has happened in recent years is that we have seen the kind of things happen that you have described. We do have, and maybe this is not really new, but we do have these enormous bills that are presented on rather short notice, and members of Congress are voting on them, and who knows? There may not be one person that knows everything, or not very many people that know everything that's in there. Also, apparently, one of the things that has happened is that when a vote is taking place, the time allowed for the vote is much longer. Roll call votes on the House floor, from what I understand, are supposed to take 15 minutes.
Yes.
And infrequently now, they apparently have been stretched hours, many hours.
Yes.
And what that gives lobbyists and other people the opportunity to do is to go looking for votes and seeing just what sort of arm twisting they can do. And I think that some people have said that you can talk all you want about lobbying reform, and that's fine, but that these things that are departures from what has been considered to be the good order of operation of the Congress, that's also a problem, and that if the Congress does not address the way that it does business, then we're still going to have a problem.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's absolutely correct. You know, so I think you're seeing, you know, it's interesting to me that when you see the reform proposals that have been, and this is, you know, I'm not privy to anything, any sort of special information, it's just what I'm reading in the newspaper, but the proposals that are being put forth by members of Congress, the Democrats and the Republicans, as you say, are not really tackling how they do business, but rather how lobbyists do business. And, you know, many of the editorials and sort of op-ed pieces that I've seen over the last couple of weeks have rather talked about, gee, maybe Congress actually needs to pay some attention to how they're getting things done.
Mm-hmm. It's something else that, and this is also, you touched on this, and I'm sure that it's difficult to assess in a broad kind of way just how successful lobbyists are.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems that we don't have that many cases as barefaced as that of Mr. Abramoff,
yeah.
Where somebody is going to a member of Congress and saying, I want you to vote this way on this bill, and if you do, I will give you this money.
Right.
You know, it's only a bribe if you can establish a quid pro quo. That clearly that is, but most people don't, are operating in an area that is much more gray than that. So then in my mind, that leads to this question, well, how do you ever really know how effective lobbyists are? How do they know how effective they are? It may indeed be clear that certain legislation is passed that seems to benefit certain industry, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But overall, is it really possible to for anybody to measure how much lobbying is really successful? I mean, given the fact that there are so many people involved and that there are competing interests.
No, I think it is tricky to determine precisely what the impact is. I mean, when you talk to some groups and you ask them about what sort of impact they thought they had on some issue that they cared about, some of them are very kind of thoughtful about the process, and they'll say almost what you just described. You know, it's really hard to know. You know, we try our best. We try to work with our allies. We try to, you know, give people information that we think is useful for them, people being members of Congress, useful information for them to have, but we don't really know. In other instances, you'll hear organizations talk about, you know, we saw the language that we wanted in this bill that moved out of committee, you know, because a lot of it isn't simply about big votes that are occurring, but they're looking to sort of shape legislation in other ways, the content of bills that come forward and the content of different proposals. And in some ways, you know, groups will say, you know, we know that we had an impact because we saw the language that we wanted. Now, maybe it's the case that five other organizations also wanted that language, so it's not them alone, and there is a lot of activity by organizations that occurs through coalition work. But, you know, knowing precisely whether you were the decisive factor, you being the organization, were the decisive factor in making something happen, boy, that's an awfully tricky thing to figure out.
We have a couple of callers here to continue our conversation, and let me again introduce our guest for anyone who might have tuned in. Marie Hognacki is Associate Professor of Political Science at Penn State University, and we're talking about lobbying, policymaking, and influence in Washington. Questions, comments, certainly welcome. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that's 800-222-9455. We have a couple of callers here, and next in line is listening in Charleston, and that would be line number 4, our toll-free line. Hello.
Yes. This past Friday, I was at a forum here at Eastern Illinois University in Charleston with five Chinese jurists who spoke no English, and so I had to talk to them through an interpreter. But my question to them as jurist and yourself, you're, as David's guest, in academics, how is it possible that we can construe any sort of democracy or any sort of people power, which is what I try to question them about, when you have a dictatorship of a majority party, such as it is now in the U.S., and then from what this conversation has been about, that even the party system, which is corrupted by the process of lobbying, and then introduce money into that. Well, how far afield, then, have we come? And the continual, I mean daily, in every part of sort of print and broadcast news, that we live in a democracy. I find that to be so chilling and so untenably used as an opiate to the people who think, you know, as a mass, that we live in a democracy, and this is how a democracy works, when that is patently what goes on is criminal. And then it has gone on ever since the establishment of civil government, whether it is state, local, or federal. And at this, as we speak, our former governor, who is not the first in Illinois history, is on trial for the very things that this conversation is going on about. As an academic, my question to you, as I did to the jurist, how is it possible when you have a dictatorship of a minority party, how can that even be a glimpse of any sort of democratic process? Mm-hmm. That's my question.
Well, and that's a big question. Obviously, there are some people who would say, yes, if you have one party that has such complete control and also would fold into that the concerns a lot of people have about campaign finance and money in politics, they probably would argue, I think as the caller does, is that if those things remain unchanged, then the other problems that we're talking about, then things are not likely to change there.
Yeah, I mean, I think that let me kind of think of the question from two different angles. One is the sort of democracy part of it, the possibility for democracy, and then the notion of the impact of the political parties, because I actually think that there's something very interesting that may be happening relatively recently on that. But, you know, in terms of the role that groups play in the democratic process, I mean, unfortunately, we as a society, not just we as me as an academic, but we as a society don't hear the stories. You know, the media does not report on the day-to-day activities of lobbyists, which are not that, in many cases, there are a lot of, you know, lobbyists in Washington, D.C. who live, you know, pretty un-Jack Abramoff lives. You know, they don't make nearly as much money. They don't have the sort of glamorous day-to-day lunches and trips that we see there, and we don't hear about it because it's kind of boring and usual, and these are people who, depending on your political preferences, are either doing good things or bad things. In some cases, you know, organizations, be they business organizations, citizen organizations, occupational groups, whatever, are magnifying the interests of the unorganized, and you know, and members of Congress listen to organized interests rather than unorganized voices, because it's easier for them to do that. And so groups, interest groups, can do good things. Oftentimes they can bring issues to the fore that might not otherwise receive attention. When you look sometimes now at funding for breast cancer and for other types of different diseases, interest groups are often the ones who have been responsible for placing those issues on the agenda. So there are some good things that organizations can do, but there are also ways in which, by virtue of what they are, groups are looking out for their own selfish interests at the expense of maybe the larger public good. And I think that's you know, what the caller was talking about, that's the sort of troubling part for democracy. But in terms of the impact that the parties have, I mean, I think that I have absolutely no evidence exactly that this is what's happening, but I've been thinking a lot about this over the last few weeks as this scandal has emerged. And I'm wondering if how groups attempt to exert influence may have changed as a result of the increasing partisanship in Congress. And what I mean by that is, you know, we have a Republican leadership now that, regardless of whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, I think most people would agree that it's a Republican leadership apparatus that exerts incredibly tight control over members of the caucus. And there is, you know, strong, Congress is much more partisan today than it was 5 or 10 years ago. Well, advocates in that kind of system, advocates primarily need to concern themselves with gaining access to the leadership, I would think. And because there's been a huge increase in the number of leadership PACs that members of Congress have that are used to raise money not just for themselves but to give to other members of Congress, this sort of creates a system in which, you know, the party apparatus, and in this case the party that controls both branches, has a tremendous amount of control over the kinds of things that happen because they exert so much influence over the members of their own caucus. And so, viewed through that light, when you think about the K Street Project, which was really all about kind of funneling a connection between a number of organizations in Washington and the leadership in Congress, that's kind of a different way of looking at what's been happening with lobbying, certainly than it was even a few years ago when the parties didn't exert quite as much control in Congress. So that just would be an observation I would have on that.
One of the things that's apparently up for discussion in Congress in terms of lobbying reform would be to already now there is a waiting period for people who have been federal employees before they can become lobbyists, although there are a lot of them. And apparently, for example, according to the Washington Monthly, I came across this in one of the articles that I read, since 1998, more than 2,200 former federal employees, 275 former White House aides, 250 former members of Congress have registered as lobbyists. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I think that is up for discussion is to make the waiting period longer. Essentially, make them have to wait longer before they can do this. Mm-hmm. Do you think that indeed would have much in the way of a practical effect?
No, no, I really don't, because it's even if the person themselves is not the person who is doing the actual lobbying, they're still you're not restricting them from holding the position that they hold, and so they can certainly tell other lobbyists at the organization who to make contact with or who's the important staffer to make sure that you know you can make phone calls and say, I'm sending so-and-so over to have a conversation with you about this. It's someone from our office. I really think you should spend time talking to them. So I just don't think that will make much of a difference. I don't know what you do to restrict people who have that kind of special expertise and access. I don't know what you do to keep them from, I think it's probably a good thing to, I saw something about a regulation that was going to prevent them from being on the floor of the chamber when a vote was occurring. That's probably a good thing, but increasing the length of time I don't think is going to do a whole heck of a lot.
Hmm. Let's talk with someone else. Urbana here, line number one. Hello.
Oh, yeah, hi. I've always been really cynical about the whole political system. There's a British economist who says basically capitalism is institutionalized selfishness, and your guest mentioned the selfish interest of the parties involved. But also, ironically, there was a TV show years ago, Larry Sanders, who one of the characters said, America's not a country, it's a company. And why people are outraged at the way money's thrown around in Washington or any other special interest is just, I mean, if it's to their benefit, for instance, health care for the poor or whatever, and if you want to pay a lobbyist. But it seems like everybody seems to miss the whole point that it's all about money. It always has been and it always will be. So, I mean, I don't know. It's just, I think, you know, David's question about is this stuff, does it even work? I mean, how good or effective is all this money thrown at these congressmen? And you would think that with the amount of stuff thrown over the years, let's say 20 years ago, that there would be some studies to say, well, you know, this company, you know, spent, these companies or group of companies or whatever spent all this money, what were the outcome and or what was the outcome of this? And that strikes me as a really, that there's no data on that. That strikes me as really an odd thing. But that's all, that's my opinion on this, but thank you.
Yeah, well, Professor Hojnacki, what do you think?
Well, there have been studies that have tried to establish a connection between contributions and votes, members' votes on policy issues. And then most of those studies, nearly all of those studies, have found absolutely no connection. And one of the reasons that it's been so difficult to, you know, and this is, there are just piles of these studies, especially from the 1980s into the early 1990s, just tons of people that were, you know, political scientists were frustrated, as your caller is saying, you know, a lot of political scientists are cynics, saying, gee, there should be some connection here. And it's difficult to find a connection because once you're, when you start to look for it, you do have to take into account, well, what's the member's predisposition? What's the member of Congress's predisposition to begin with? Do they already, this is what I was talking about earlier, do they already agree with what the group wants, the group that's giving them money, what they want anyway? And if they do, then are they voting the way they're voting because you gave them money, or are they voting the way they're voting because either this is their predisposition because they're partisan affiliation or because of, you know, there's a lot of ties between the money that's given and the interests and supporters in a legislator's district. So is it because of district preferences that the member is voting the way that they're voting? So I don't disagree that that there's a lot of money being spent and that it doesn't necessarily, you know, the appearance of all of that money and not knowing and, you know, in conjunction with these instances of scandal don't paint a particularly comforting picture. But at the same time, it's tricky to try to establish that kind of a connection. And I think that, you know, I don't think the conclusion to take from that is that political scientists think that money doesn't matter, but rather it matters in some different ways. So, for example, you know, groups that are richer in terms of money and other resources certainly have advantages over organizations that don't have as much money and other resources. And I think one of the things that political scientists have found is that with organizations that have more resources are better are able to sort of focus on a lot of different issues rather than choosing one or maybe a few issues that they really have to spend time on. Groups that don't have as many, have as much money or have as many resources often have to pick and choose and say, well, we're only going to involve ourselves in healthcare reform because that's a really big issue and everybody's going to be talking about it. Well, it's also an issue that's, you know, perennially discussed and often goes nowhere, and organizations that have a lot more resources might be involved in healthcare reform, but they might also be involved in some sort of legislation about, you know, pharmaceutical regulation and something else involving the way that, you know, businesses pay taxes. So, you know, they don't have to prioritize or restrict their activity in the same way as groups that really are more strapped.
Mm-hmm. Well, it just I can imagine a lot of people frustrated like the caller who would look at any particular kind of issue where there are sharp differences and they would say something like, well, you know, look at the amount of money that all of the interests that are related to the fossil fuel industry, say, for example, give to political candidates and then also spend on lobbying, and then set that against the amount of money that is spent by organizations that are interested in environmental issues like global warming and renewable energy. And we see that the fossil fuel people are spending lots more money than the environmentalist and the renewable energy people. So should we be so surprised that if you look at American energy policy, the emphasis continues to be on traditional fossil fuels and not so much on the other things? I mean, that it doesn't seem to be that hard. People will say it doesn't seem to be that hard to draw a straight line between money spent and the policy that results. And I can imagine them being frustrated with a political scientist saying, well, you know, yeah, it looks that way, but we're just not really quite sure exactly how that works.
I guess my point would be that it's not that I'm saying that there is no connection there, because as I said, I do think, you know, money allows you to do a whole host of things. The point that I'm trying to make is that I don't think the policies are being purchased for campaign contributions, because in the big scheme of things, any group is able to give only a relatively, if you're operating legally, how much money you can give as an organization is pretty restricted. But there we're only talking about campaign contributions. It doesn't mean that, you know, if I'm an organization representing, you know, fossil fuels of some sort, we may have piles of money so that in our organization we have media specialists, we have researchers that do work for us and produce studies that we can provide not just to members of Congress but also to the media, because I think they're part of this equation as well. We can hire all sorts of lobbyists that have contacts with different members of Congress. And if I'm the, you know, to use your example, the relatively poor environmental organization, I may have one or two staff members that are involved with any issue that is of interest to our organization, and so their time has to be divided over the course of all of those issues. We don't have any specialized staff to do all these other sorts of things, and so we're just not, I mean, we can't keep up, basically, with the nature of advocacy activities that these other organizations are engaged in. So my point is that it is not that it doesn't matter, but that it's not a bribe. It's not looking for the quid pro quo. We're focused in on the wrong things, I think.
Well, let's try and talk with a couple of more people here. We have someone in another Charleston person here, line number two. Hello.
Thank you for taking my call. This is the question of all that money that is spent on lobbying appears to be focused on influencing the budget in the billions. And are there any rules or guidelines that limit the kinds of amendments that seem to be tacked on to the basic bills that appear to be the pork that everybody is so angry about? Mm-hmm. Particularly us ordinary citizens who pay the taxes. Mm-hmm. I appreciate your answering this question. Thank you.
Sure.
Sure. No, that's a great question. And essentially, no, there are not a lot of restrictions. I mean, when a bill comes to the floor, it's the Rules Committee in Congress that decides whether that bill is going to come to the floor protected from amendments or not protected from amendments. And so if it's a bill that the leadership doesn't want, you know, debated in a lot of ways or tacked with a bunch of, you know, sort of amendments that might affect its passage, they may restrict activity. In other instances, they'll allow things to be put on. But this gets back to the conversation we were having earlier about the activities of Congress, where there are no restrictions on how some of, you know, this is really, I mean, all these various questions are all about how policy is made. If there are no restrictions on how you can make something happen, how you can make policy, then, you know, then it's fair game for people to engage in these activities, which for all of us, you know, all of us on the outside, we sort of look at this process and say, this is ridiculous. How does it make any sense at all to make policy that involves spending tax dollars where no one gets a chance to talk about it, really, and everybody gets to put their pet projects on? I mean, I think that is really sort of crazy, but it's something that these are rules of Congress, not rules that involve what lobbyists can do necessarily.
Colin, does that get at your question?
Yes, I was just wondering if there's possibility of changing or implementing some rules that in the future, because this money question is just going to keep getting greater and greater, particularly with the amount of money that lobbyists seem to have available to throw around.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Or is this just left up to the Rules Committee then?
Well, it will go beyond the Rules Committee, but it really does in this case. I think for things to change, it requires that members of Congress themselves either become disgusted by or embarrassed by the process. And you do have some people, some very fiscally conservative Republicans, or some people that have, you know, John McCain is often touted as a person who's very anti-pork. You do have some members that do not like this process, this way of legislating and making policy. But until there's a push in Congress to reform their own rules to make this happen, it's going to be the way it is. And I don't know whether, you know, we were talking earlier about Congress is saying, well, let's reform what the lobbyists do, and people on the outside are saying, well, gee, maybe Congress should actually think about changing some of its rules. To what extent that becomes more of a part of the public debate on this issue, then Congress is going to, I think, really be forced to sort of take some responsibility for what's happening. But whether that actually does happen, I don't know.
Well, we don't seem to be set up to have that kind of debate.
No,
it seems that most of the member of Congress are, as you say, we're talking about tightening the rules under which lobbyists are operating. Mm-hmm. And I don't hear many members of Congress saying, well, you know, maybe we ought to look at the way that we operate. Well, I think we're almost to the point where we're going to have to stop, and perhaps I should apologize. We have one more caller. I don't think that we're going to be able to take. Any last sort of thought that you'd like to leave with folks?
No, well, I guess part of what we've been talking about in many aspects of this have come through the questions, which have been great, is that, you know, the process is a really complicated one, and as I said, you know, to my frustration with the Abramoff scandal is really that it does kind of it diverts attention to the thing that is least common. You know, he's a criminal. He was involved in bribing and he was involved in coercion. And there are always going to be some members of Congress, just like there are people everywhere, who are willing to engage in that kind of a relationship. But for the most part, the way that money flows into Washington and the kinds of things that advocates engage in, you know, giving information to the media, giving information to members of Congress, stirring up the grassroots, making contributions, you know, there's a whole host of things that organizations do. And there is, you know, organizations are not equal, and some of them have a lot more resources. And being attentive to who's spending time in Congress and who they're talking to and what they're trying to make happen, I think it tells us a lot more as citizens about what's going on and who is at least attempting to exert influence.